Welcome to the Theopolis Podcast. I'm here today with James Bijan and Alistair Roberts. Jeff Myers is not present with us this week. He's normally part of the team. He's busy, no doubt, with church business, pastoral business, and we look forward to having him back in the next round of recordings. Brian Motes is, as usual, right in the foreground. I'm placing him in the foreground in order to, as he's recording. You won't hear his voice, but he is very much with us the whole time. Brian is the one who edits and cleans up everything, takes out. I'm sure he doesn't remove every time I say because that would be like reduce the podcast by a third. But he takes out all kinds of odd noises and pauses and makes it much easier to listen to. So thanks to Foreground Brian for being with us today. We are in the book of Deuteronomy, and we are in Deuteronomy 24. This is part of the eighth word section of Deuteronomy. And the eighth word section is dealing with economic relations, focally in the 10 words. It's concerned with stealing and theft, but there are varieties of different kinds of economic abuses and oppression that are being covered here in chapter 24. And one of the things that we'll talk about a good bit in this episode is the question of pledges for loans. So when you give a loan, can you take collateral for that loan from the person you're lending to? And if you can't take collateral as a pledge for the repayment of that loan, what are the rules governing what you can take in pledge, what you do with that pledge, and so on? And there are a number of five or six verses in Deuteronomy 24 that deal with this. And I think that this is a good example. The pledge rules are good examples of the way that Deuteronomy portrays what I've described in a couple of previous episodes as an embedded economy. That term is coming from Carl Polanyi's book, The Great Transformation, and what he means by it, and what I've meant by it when talking about it in the past, is that economic relations are not purely economic, but they're intertwined with and infused with other kinds of social relations. So Deuteronomy talks about how we treat brothers in the market, how we deal with brothers who are slaves as opposed to non-brothers who are slaves, how we deal with the poor. It's another category of people. And in our economic relations with the poor, we have to be cognizant of the fact that they are poor. That's not something we can just set aside. We treat them differently and they have certain privileges because they are in that category. So in that sense, the economy is embedded in other kinds of social relations and in political realities. But I think what's interesting in Deuteronomy is the fact that the pledge rules not only place these economic commercial relations of credit and debt within relations of brothers, but also put it in a theological context. So I think the more fundamental embedding of the economy in Deuteronomy is a theological and even liturgical embedding. And that comes out pretty neatly in verses 10 through 15. Verses 10 through 13 are a section that's dealing with pledges. We'll look at that today, I expect. But that section ends with this warning, or this promise, rather. If you deal justly with the person that you lend it to, then it will be righteousness for you before Yahweh your God. So Yahweh is the judge of the economic transaction. And if you do well in that economic transaction and you are righteous, then it will be righteousness for you before Yahweh. Yahweh will judge you righteous because of your righteous conduct in your relation to with the person who's taken a loan, with the poor man, and especially with regard to his pledge. Then verses 14 and 15, not dealing with the pledge, but with hired servants. And verse 15 comes to a very similar conclusion, except it's the negative side of it. You give him his wages on the day that he's to be paid so that he will not cry against you to Yahweh and it becomes sin to you. So on the one hand, if you do righteously, then the poor man will bless you. That's in verse 13. And it will be righteousness for you before Yahweh. If you don't treat your wage laborers rightly, then he will cry out to Yahweh and it will be sin in you. So there's a very, very close parallel between the end of verse 13 and the 15. The contrasting blessing and righteousness before Yahweh, as opposed to crying out and sin before Yahweh. But what this, the broader point that this is making, obviously, is that Yahweh is involved in these economic transactions. He's the judge and overseer of these economic transactions. He's the one that ensures that justice is ultimately done in these economic transactions. The implication of verse 15 is that if the poor man cries out to Yahweh, Yahweh will intervene on his behalf, as he did for Israel when Israel cried out against an oppressive employer, an enslaving employer, Pharaoh. The Lord will treat the poor man as Israel and will respond and will avenge the poor man and give him justice. So Yahweh is involved in all that. There's an embedding in the theological reality of Yahweh's oversight of Israel and his involvement in the economy of Israel. And there's this kind of liturgical dimension too, because in both cases we're talking about prayer. The poor man who is treated rightly blesses you. That's something that rises before Yahweh. If you treat him badly, then he will cry out against you to Yahweh, and he's asking for deliverance. So that you have this interesting combination of an asymmetrical economic relation. The creditor is the borrower is slave to the creditor. The borrower is slave to the lender. The lender has power, economic power over the borrower, and yet both of them have this equal access to Yahweh. There's this completely symmetrical relation that they have to Yahweh. God doesn't hear the prayers of the rich any more than he hears the prayers of the poor, and he will hear and respond to those who cry out for his help. So I think that's it's kind of an important theological dimension to what I've said earlier about this the embeddedness of the Israelite economy. The most important kind of embeddedness is its embeddedness in the world that's governed by the Lord, and the fact that the Lord is overseeing and judging economic relations, and he's the invisible hand of the market, who is not a hands-off invisible hand, but the one who's actually ultimately ensuring that justice is done. We left off last time at Deuteronomy 24:5, and we're starting at 24:6, which is one of the laws that has to do with pledges. And I'm going to suggest that we take 24:6 along with verses 10 through 13, because after some intervening laws in verses 7 through 9, Moses returns to the issue of the pledge. So verse 6 has to do with what can be taken in pledge. And then verses 10 through 13 have to do with how we treat the pledges that we receive, that the lender receives from the borrower, what rules are in place for ensuring that the poor man is treated righteously and justly in these relations of lending and borrowing.
Alistair made the point in a previous episode, I think, that we tend to see money as a bit of a neutral thing these days, and yet while kind of economies at their best are arrangements where two parties profit from one another, a buyer and a seller and so forth, both benefit from a transaction. Very often today, that's not the case. A hedge fund, let's say, might do very well precisely because lots of other companies do very badly. And here you've got kind of a prohibition of exactly that kind of thing, haven't you? There's a pledge given, and yet the collateral that's taken from it is, or taken for it, is actively detrimental to the productivity of the borrower. So like a mill or an upper millstone has been taken. So this guy, it's affected his output, his livelihood, potentially. The price is too great. And so everything is stacked in favor of the lender. And that seems to be a good example of the kind of one-sided transaction that Alistair was talking about before, I think.
Yes, there are a number of situations that we can see. And I think probably an extreme example of this is seen in the context of conversations about polyamory, where you have two parties within a marriage, and one of them decides, I would like to see other people and to open up this marriage to other parties. And in that sort of situation, it's very rare that both parties within a marriage have equal bargaining power. one of the things that's so important about marriage, even beyond the fact of the faithfulness and the exclusivity and the two-ness of marriage, is the fact that marriage protects parties that would not otherwise have equal bargaining power from exploitation. And when marriage is so-called opened up in that scenario, what you have is people made very vulnerable to exploitative relations, where their inability to exercise an equal bargaining power in a society where it's so easily presumed that every contract between adults is legitimate because there's consent of some kind on both sides. That just simply isn't the case. And in this sort of situation, there are off-limit transactions because it would be very easy to exploit people in that sort of situation. They would not have equal bargaining power, and it would be very easy to have predatory relations were such transactions not clearly off limits.
Yeah, are you taking the reference to handmills, upper millstones? Those are forbidden as pledges because they're necessary for the survival of the borrower. So the last clause of verse 6, he would be taking a life, or he would be taking a nephesh in pledge. The creditor can't rob the man of his life, which means he can't rob the man of his, even as a temporary pledge, you can't take something that's necessary for his survival and his, necessary for him to feed himself. Is that how you're taking those two terms?
Yeah. So by extension, basic productive capital, if you're robbing someone of their ability to make their livelihood, their tools, their vehicle, perhaps, if that is necessary for their work, in that sort of situation, it's gone beyond a healthy transaction and it's become something predatory.
Right. You could see a potential parallel to that in certain laws to do with theft or damage, couldn't you? If your cattle, let's say, grazing someone else's vineyard, then you're to make restitution from the best in your own vineyard, but really you're just kind of covering the goods that have been taken. By contrast, stealing someone else's ox, let's say, is that fivefold repayment? It's either four or fivefold. And right. Presumably the idea there is that the ox can do work, you know, and all the time you've been without it, your output, your productivity is compromised. And that seems to be the root idea here, that what's being taken as a pledge shouldn't impact someone's productivity.
I'm interested, James, with your background in banking, if you have any thoughts about how this rule applies to contemporary banking. Are there limits on what is permitted as collateral that accomplish this, that prevent somebody's livelihood from being taken? You can think about loan sharks and so on that are deliberately not obeying this, but in the mainstream of banking industry, is this something that's this kind of control observed, or is it not?
I mean, people try to regulators try to regulate it. It's very difficult to do. I mean, like you're saying, loan sharks is a form of it. High interest rate mortgages are a kind of variation on the same theme, aren't they? And they play on the kind of thing that Alistair is talking about. Someone desperately needs money, so they're in a vulnerable situation, and you can almost charge them anything you want as interest in order to get them to take out a loan with you, precisely because they're in that needy situation. And very, very unequal relationships can be developed, but it is very hard to regulate, because I mean, obviously lending money to someone like that does have a higher risk, and so charging a higher interest rate is kind of part of the way economics works, you know. And there are principles, but they're hard to enforce.
Yeah, I think that your point about the desperation, I think, is important. And I guess when we talked about usury and interest a couple of weeks ago, then we were making a distinction between commercial loans and loans that are charity loans. But that distinction gets somewhat blurred because you have people who are in various kinds of desperation that are not generally poor, but still need, you know, they need something to keep the cash flow going. So the loans are often given in situations where it's easy, as you say, to exploit. And that's precisely what the Lord is forbidding is to take advantage of that vulnerability in order to enrich yourself. Not recognizing, the language of verse 6 is quite striking. You take his soul from him. There's a kind of nearly an act of violence, an act of murder that is being charged if you take his livelihood in order to secure the loan.
Right. I mean, one of the slight disconnects, I guess, between modern economies and what's being spoken about here in Deuteronomy is that the idea of a loan in Deuteronomy is the Lord has blessed you, made you rich. You have this money and you're then to use it to help out the poor. And so it's kind of the loans are paid on the basis of what you have and how the Lord has prospered you. Now, problematically, these days, you can be a company that just loans money and basically you're in a position where you can borrow it more cheaply than you lend it. And so you just set yourself up as a basically an outfit that shovels money from one place to another. And so there is a kind of a slight lack of carry across. You're not loaning out of what you actually have. It's just funneling money from A to B. And that's where, I mean, I personally think economies get very problematic and where things kind of get disconnected from what Moses is talking about here.
I want to highlight the once again the emphasis on the soul. You're taking the soul from the man, and that's prohibited. That term is used again in verse 15 when it's talking about wages. You shall give him his wages on the day before the sun sets, for he is poor, and he sets his soul on it. He will not cry out against the Lord to you, against you to the Lord. So the treatment of a hired servant in that case is governed by the fact that you're recognizing he has desires, he has a soul, he has needs, and you treat him in a way that recognizes that he's a spiritual being, not just a physical being. And that's an interesting theme that appears in those couple of passages, that you know, the economy is not just an economy of bodies. It's not just a matter of meeting basic physical and material needs, but it's relations between souls. And economies are only humane when they're organized as with that recognition that they're the lender and the borrower share the reality of being fellow souls.
And the challenge here, as elsewhere, is finding some way to curb purely economic relations in society. So you do have economic relations. A healthy society must have such relations, but yet there also need to be places where the logic of those sorts of relations are not allowed to extend.
Yeah, and I think that I keep going back to Polanyi, but I think that his idea of an embedded economy is really crucial and helpful. And I think that the fundamental problem, it seems to me, is the extraction of an economic realm of life from everything else. And to some degree, if you extract economic life from other sorts of things, then you're somewhat diminishing the significance of economic life, because being fruitful and being productive and taking dominion are not just economic activities for human beings, but they are part of what defines us as the image of God. And they are, it's crucial to human dignity that we produce things and that we are economically active. So it's the separation of economy from other realms of life, kind of carving out that as a separate sphere, it both distorts economy because it extracts it from other sorts of relations, and it also diminishes economy because it makes economic life seem to be just about meeting basic material needs and not about being human, about being souls.
One listener, in response to our discussion of usury, was asking about what I made of Islamic banking and other religious attempts to avoid certain types of economic transactions. And I was curious whether James, given his background, has interacted with any of these particular approaches to modern banking in terms of such laws, and whether there are particular Christian proposals that he's found thought-provoking or helpful in this regard.
I'm afraid I haven't. I'm not even entirely sure on how Sharia banking works, insofar as I'm pretty sure they do charge some amount of interest, don't they? But don't they kind of classify it in a certain way? Is that the idea?
I'm not sure.
Right, yeah. I don't know either. I mean, I suppose in my personal life, when I have lent money to particular individuals, I've interpreted usury as kind of extortionate interest rates above what would kind of keep you level with inflation. And so I've operated on the principle of kind of loaning not being a profit-making activity. So I've kind of distinguished, I've tried to distinguish sort of the interest that keeps track with the cost of living from interest as a general principle. And so I haven't operated on a kind of 0% interest loan, if that makes sense. But my experience of kind of Sharia law and so on is next to nothing.
Yeah, same here. But I think, I mean, the point you're making, James, with the keeping up with inflation is that you actually are equalizing the repayment. The repayment is the same value as what you loaned, but because of inflation, the money that they pay back is worth less per unit, and you have to have an interest rate to equalize it.
Right, right.
The second pledge section comes in verses 10 through 13 of Deuteronomy 24, and this has two different rules. One has to do, interestingly, with how you acquire the pledge, verses 10 and 11. And what's prohibited here is for a lender to enter the house of the borrower in order to take the pledge, and maybe in order to select it, or even to, it's prohibited from even going inside. Even if you're going inside and not selecting something that you would like as a pledge. But verse 11 says explicitly, you shall remain outside. So that's the first rule. Verses 12 and 13 has to do with what can be borrowed again. The last time it was about don't take something that that the man needs for life. This is, I think, is the same vein. The poor man that you're lending to, you shouldn't take something from him that he needs for the night. Corresponding law in Exodus mentions the cloak. That verse 13 mentions a cloak. If you take his cloak in pledge and then you take the cloak home and he doesn't have it to sleep in that night, then he doesn't have anything to keep him warm. If you give him the cloak, you keep it in pledge during the day, you give it to him at night, and then he'll be able to sleep and be warm, and then he'll bless you. That's what will be righteousness before the Lord. So again, two different rules concerning govern how pledges are to be used in loans and borrowing. I think it's particularly interesting. The first one is particularly interesting to me, the way that the situation is set up. The man's house, he's your debtor, but his house remains inviolable to you. And there's a kind of quasi-sanctuary privilege, even though he's in this position of subordination to you. And he is a kind of slave to you. That doesn't mean he's yielding everything, the dignity of having his own house. And it's almost like verse 11, the fact that the lender remains outside. The picture is almost of the lender standing out as almost as a sentry, guarding the integrity of the borrower's home. I mean, in a general sense, what's specifically prohibited is entering the home at all. And what's generally being established is the sphere that the even when borrowing, even when a debtor, you have a sphere of life that is your own, and credit does not rob you of that dignity. And the creditor is, in some sense, supposed to be a guardian of the integrity of the borrower's property.
Right. I mean, the fundamental theme underlying the whole thing seems to be the same, doesn't it? Personal possessions stroke property are to be respected. They're sacrosanct in a certain way. And so just as it's not right to steal, or it wouldn't be right for this person who's borrowed to steal, likewise, it's not as if the lender now just has some right or authority over the person who's borrowing from him. He's got to respect that person's possessions. And I think we saw a kind of similar merging of property with other commandments earlier. Wasn't the moving a boundary stone or something? Wasn't that within the murder section? And
yes.
Right. So kind of that's also just encroaching into someone's life, isn't it? And crossing boundaries in that sense. And it seems important. I mean, one related question, I guess we'll go back to this, won't we, is how verses 8 to 9, which are sort of sandwiched in the midst of these, how that works, and whether we're actually sort of segueing into a new section at this point.
We can look at those intervening laws, verses 7 through 9, intrude between these three rules concerning pledges that we've just been looking at. Verse 7 deals with stealing a man. Again, it's soul is the word, stealing a nephesh, stealing a soul. And that's prohibited. And in fact, it's treated as a capital crime. The thief shall die. You shall purge the evil from among you. That language of purging the evil from among you has been used regularly throughout Deuteronomy to describe what the death penalty is for. You don't want the evil of these sins and injustices to be to take root in the midst of Israel, in the innards of Israel. And so the death penalty plays a purgative role. This is different from most punishments for theft. If you steal property, then you have to make restitution, some double restitution, sometimes, as James already mentioned, this multiple restitution. So usually property crimes are not punished by the death penalty, but here they are. This one is, even though the language is stealing, but because what's being stolen is the soul, that means it's a death penalty and it's tantamount to murder.
What do you guys think is in mind with the memory of Miriam? So there is clearly the connection to leprosy. So 8 and 9 go together, but why is this mentioned here? How does it fit in?
Oh, Callum Carmichael, in his eccentric treatment of the laws of Deuteronomy, I don't remember where it starts, but he talks about this section as being an Egyptian section of the book of Deuteronomy, where you have rules that have some allusion to reference back to Israel's experience in Egypt. Verse 7, the notion of stealing a man comes up in the Joseph narrative. Joseph is stolen from the land and taken to Egypt. Verse 7 talks about selling somebody who's been kidnapped, and Joseph is sold a couple of times after he's sold by his brothers, and he's sold by the Ishmaelites, Midianites, who take him to Egypt. He's sold to Potiphar. And then, I mean, what's curious about it is or theologically interesting about the Joseph story against this law is that the brothers who kidnapped him and sold him are not killed, but forgiven and reconciled. So you have the Joseph story behind verse 7. Obviously you have explicitly Miriam, who is brought up at the time of the Exodus, following the Exodus, and this episode about her leprosy is told in the book of Numbers. You have verses 14 and 15 have to do with hired servants who are not paid for their work, and those cry out. I've already mentioned that that's a kind of Exodus motif where Israel's crying out against the Lord, against Pharaoh, crying out to the Lord in order to intervene and save them from Pharaoh. And then at the end of the chapter, you have a couple of explicit references to remembering that you were a slave in Egypt. Verse 18, after a general rule not to pervert justice to the alien, the orphan, the widow, remember you were a slave in Egypt. And then a series of laws that have to do with gleaning. And then verse chapter 24 ends with you were a slave in Egypt. And that you remember that you were a slave in Egypt as a motivation for these laws or justification for the laws. So at least that, Carmichael's exposition of these laws, to my mind, gets very opaque and complicated, and I don't follow his reasoning all the time. But I think he's right about there's this kind of Exodus motif that's running through here. If that's right, then it seems like that does continue past verse 9. So that would be an argument for saying that verse 9 is not, as some have argued, the end of a section, but it's still, the following verses are still part of this concern for economic activity and under the eighth word rubric.
I would be inclined to put this under the ninth word. My sense is that it's referring to the connection between, among other things, the connection between leprosy and attacks upon rightful authority. So we might think about Gehazi in 2 Kings chapter 5, where he lies to his master Elisha. We might think about Uzziah, the king, when he resists the priests and seeks to sacrifice. And then clearly in this case, Miriam, as she and Aaron speak against Moses on account of, I think, Zipporah, the Cushite woman. And in all of these cases, there's some assault upon authority which leads to leprosy. But then there's a connection that might be seen in the other direction, which is particularly dealt with here, which is that the Levites who have to enact the law in the case of leprosy would be very vulnerable to people speaking against them, slandering them, opposing them. I mean, the sorts of things that they have to do would be incredibly unpleasant and disruptive and unpopular. They can remove people from the camp, require them to live away from others. They have to call out unclean. They may even tear down a person's house. And you can imagine that, like Miriam, people would be tempted to speak against the Levites in such a situation. And so the Lord commands his servants, and it's essential that the people honor his servants. And so leprosy was the punishment for the false witness that Miriam gave against Moses. And so leprosy is a particular is a situation where this sense of lawful authorities that must be honored in unpopular situations is really, there's a very strong connection of different principles there. And so I'd suggest that this is about the sin of false witness against divinely appointed leaders in their inaction of the unpopular laws of the Ten Commandments.
On the contrary view, that this is a continuation, is included in the eighth word. I think there are structural reasons for thinking it's continuing. You have the law about pledge in verse 6, and then pledges, of course, come up in verses 10 through 13 again, as we've already talked about. And you have some of the same terminology that's used. Verse 7 is clear to talk about stealing. It actually uses the verb steal. And then you have similar language that's coming up in 10 through 13, and then 14 and 15, as I've already pointed out. Verses 13 and 15 link up very, very symmetrical, the end of those two verses. So it seems to me like the structure indicates that the rule about leprosy has to do with theft. I think that you're right, certainly right, about the authority and the violation of authority that's in view here. That's explicit in verse 8. You guard against an infection of leprosy by diligently guarding and doing what the Levitical priests teach you. I took that as a more general exhortation, not specifically about the Levites dealing with a case of leprosy, but rather leprosy is one of the things that will afflict Israel if they don't guard and do what the Levites teach. in general. So leprosy among the strokes and diseases of Egypt, at the end of Deuteronomy, Israel is going to be warned if they violate the covenant that the Lord is going to bring the diseases of Egypt on them. And the word for disease is the same as the word for stroke of leprosy here. So if you don't do what according to the Levites guard and teach, then the Lord is going to bring these infections and this stroke on you. And Miriam is a case study of that. Of course, that leaves me with the problem of trying to explain how this is an eighth word commandment. And I think you could talk about, theft of authority or violation of authority as a kind of theft, something along those lines. But those are my thoughts for continuing to see this as eighth word.
Yeah, I wonder if, Peter, what you're saying and what Alistair is saying can be brought together by making a similar kind of blurring between lying and theft, or more particularly in the case of slander, insofar as slander is the stealing of someone's good reputation or the taking away of their rightful name. I mean, I have often seen, I'm not sure if I'm necessarily right in this, but when Miriam and Aaron accuse Moses of being married to this Cushite, I mean, Zipporah, I'm pretty sure, is the daughter of Jethro, isn't she? So the priest of Midian. I don't know in what sense she could be termed a Cushite, like an Ethiopian. I mean, Cush can refer just to sort of dark skin, and I wonder if it's actually just an abusive term. I mean, it's a derogatory term in modern Hebrew, certainly to refer to probably, I think, explicitly to Ethiopians. But I wonder if it is actually a case of slander originally in Numbers 12, what's going on with Moses.
The Lord certainly speaks on Moses' behalf. Moses doesn't defend himself, but the Lord speaks concerning Moses' character. On the connection between Zipporah and Cush, my suspicion is that Midian is referred to using that language. So, for instance, in Habakkuk 3:7, I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. And so Cush, of course, can refer to that African context, but it can also refer to the Midianites.
Okay, that kind of makes sense. I mean, it's sort of only over the other side of the sea, isn't it, compared to Ethiopia? So, yeah, that works.
One of the things that this these couple of verses brought up, and trying to think through New Testament fulfillments, how these are pointing to Christ, how they're typological, and just the frequency of Jesus' encounters with lepers in the first century. Quite striking how often he's cleansing lepers in his ministry, not only individual lepers, but also lepers are among the groups of afflicted people that come to Jesus for healing. And if you think of the stroke of leprosy as something that is associated with Egypt, one of the diseases of Egypt that is threatening Israel if they break covenant, then Jesus entering into an Israel that is afflicted with leprosy, where there's widespread skin disease, widespread affliction, means that this is a people haven't listened to what the priests are teaching. And, you know, actually what's happening in first century Israel is that the priests and Pharisees are not teaching the law as they ought. So it's not that the people violate that, but the teachers themselves are violating. And so Jesus comes in order to enact an exodus out of the diseases of Egypt, and every cleansing of a leper is a kind of small-scale exodus that brings one particular person out of this affliction of Egypt and into the land or into the kingdom of Jesus and the kingdom of healing.
On the categorization of this material, just looking back on James Jordan's treatment of this in Covenant Sequence in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, he places the section from verse 8 of this chapter to verse 3 of the next under the ninth commandment. And it seems to me if we didn't have it categorized that way, we'd probably, if we didn't categorize the leprosy part under the ninth commandment, we'd probably just have verses 1 to 3 as the whole ninth commandment section. The rest of it would be more like, would seem to gravitate more to the eighth. But one of the things this makes me think about is the relationship between the eighth and the ninth, the closeness of the material and the sort of blurring of the lines makes me think about the way in which both of these are dealing with situations of oppression and justice, and the blurring of this line helps us to also see another facet of the ninth commandment, which is that bearing false witness has a sort of law court background, where false witness actually is something that will be backed up by the authority of the government or the authority of the court, and it will lead to serious consequences against your neighbor on account of government, the actions of the authorities against them. And so what's taking place here is an exploration of not just general lying or general cases of slandering someone, but situations where the structures that should be bringing justice are used as means of oppression of one's neighbor. And that connection with stealing is also, it's exploring a complex of ideas that otherwise we might not see so clearly. And so the blurring of the lines is not entirely without reason.
Yeah, that seems helpful. I mean, paradigmatically, the bearing false witness is more often than not in order to deprive people of things that they kind of have a right to, you know, companies blurring the truth in order to deprive their customers, or governments doing it in order to deprive their people. There does just seem to be that fundamental connection between the two, doesn't there?
Yeah, in addition to that, as you said, James, that you're depriving somebody of reputation, of the honor of their reputation by speaking slanderously against somebody. There is a kind of theft in that. I think that's helpful that you have a blurring of things. I still not convinced that we make a transition. And it's interesting that you do have that kind of blurring, because in other cases that we've looked at, the transition has seemed fairly clear as we move from one of the 10 words to the next. We seem pretty obviously to be moving from one zone of concern to another. And sometimes there are structural things that reinforce that. But here, that whatever position we're taking, I think it's true that the lines are not obvious. And that does, as Alistair says, suggestive that we're talking about two phenomena that have some kind of interconnection with each other.
Thank you again for enjoying this episode of the Theopolis Podcast. For more information and for more content from Theopolis, you can check us out online at theopolisinstitute.com. We release new articles every Tuesday and Thursday on our blog, so you'll want to make sure to look out for those. You can also find us on Twitter at _Theopolis and on Facebook if you just search for our name. If you've been helped, sharpened, and encouraged by this podcast, we'd really love it if you would go to iTunes and leave us a review. It just takes a few seconds, and it really will help us along in getting our content in front of new listeners. That's all for now, friends. We really look forward to being with you all again in the next episode. And as always, thank you so much for listening.